This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Knife Talk. The only show to listen to if you're interested in knives, whether you're a maker, a collector, whoever you may be. We go live every Monday morning, most Monday mornings, with a new show with myself, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, Jeff Fader of Fader Knives, and Mareko Marmassi of Marmassi Fire Arts. How are you guys?
Doing good.
How are Pretty you? Good.
Good, good. Good, good. Everybody seems up this week, which is good. I can only apologise for what happened with last week's show. As I said, we normally go live every Monday. For some reason, on Apple, it was just given a blank file.
Yeah, weird.
Yeah, and I re-uploaded the file and I listened to it. Everything was great. Working on Spotify, but not on Apple. So maybe the AI bots who we were discussing on the show got wind of what we were up to and decided to fuck things up.
Oh, no. Are we getting Shadow Man on Apple?
No.
Quite possibly.
No.
Who knows? But anyway, it's all good. So, yeah, if you do want to listen to that show, which was a very good one, actually, if you are on Apple, if you can just, in the podcast now, if you delete the episode, it'll re-download it and you should be good. But top tip for everybody, don't listen to podcasts on Apple anyway.
Cause it's Why? Really,
it's terrible. Because it's just
really bad. Really bad. Overcast is the app to use for podcasts, by the way.
It's Overcast?
Amazing. Overcast, yeah.
That's a
yeah,
new
yeah,
one for me.
It's been around for years. It's great. So it does little things like, say, you know, you're halfway through, you listen in the car, you're halfway through. Next time you jump in the car, it'll like automatically go back 20 seconds to remind you where you were.
It
syncs really nicely. Overcast is the one,
Overcast.
Yeah. Yeah, you can skip ads. You can skip ads. That kind of thing. So, yeah, it's all good.
Are they a sponsor? Are they a new sponsor?
They're not, but yeah, it's just that whenever we have an issue, people are always saying, oh, it's with Apple or it's with Spotify and so on. Personally, I used a third-party service called Overcast. You can download it to any phone. It's just a really good service. Yeah. Anyway, back to us. It's all about us. Mareko, what's been going on?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you what. I was making some steel yesterday, and something really unfortunate happened. I was brushing the forge scale off the billet, and even though I was wearing eye protection, a little piece of, like, 600-degree forge scale flew into my eye.
Oh, no.
And thankfully, I slammed the fucking billet back into the forge, ran out to the truck, because I don't have any mirrors in the shop, apparently, which I think I need to remedy.
That pretty face, of course you do.
Fuck that. No, I just need to be able to see my goddamn eyeball. And it was only the size of a grain of like sand, but at, you know, a few hundred degrees, it's pretty uncomfortable. But thankfully I was able to get it off my eye before it like seared to my eyeball or whatever. But the rest of the day I kept having this feeling in my left eye. Like, I still had more shit in there. And I kept looking, probably irritating my eye, but there was nothing there. And then I was telling my kid about it, and I was looking in the mirror again, and I could see, this time I had the flashlight, like, right up to my face, and my face up to the mirror. And I had, like, blisters and burns underneath my eyelid and against the edge of my eye, my lower edge of my eye. Mm. And so, thankfully, it's feeling better today. But that was very uncomfortable. Ugh. And I'm sure there are so many opportunities in the past where things could have been way worse. I didn't used to wear eye protection when I was forging, but now I try to wear eye protection all the time.
Yeah.
Even when I'm doing acids and stuff, actually, just in case a little droplet wants to try to splash up in your eye. Ugh, that's the last thing you
Do you need. Have like an eye wash station, like an eye bath?
I have the hairdresser's sink, remember? I have a hairdresser's sink in my shop, so yeah, I just turn that thing on, just blast it in my face, and I'm good. I might as well have a hose hooked up in my shop.
You can get a couple little saline things just
Yeah, that's what
further.
I mean. I don't know it.
No, I know what you're saying. That's probably actually a really good idea. Because shit happens. And it's good to be prepared when it does, rather than be racing around with your eyes closed in a metal shop while the forge is going. Other than that, my Devil Skull. So I was down in Eugene the other day, last weekend, and it was fun down there, and had a blast with the 10 Dicks and hanging out with those guys and getting to see Jay Spake and hanging out with the Acre Forge guys or crew from Portland, Oregon, and met some new faces. Yeah, it was a good time down at the Eugene show. And oh, J.D. Smith was there. I hadn't seen him since like 2018. J.D. Smith is a ABS Master Smith. Super good dude and a talented Damascus maker. He won actually Best Damascus, Best of Show. The kid had his Lego. He has some Lego dragons on display. He has this great book called Dragopedia. If there are any dragon nerds out there, it's a fucking really good book. But he built some Lego design projects, like designed and based off of some of these creatures in the books. And he's just like, he's making up these designs and they look very good. Like they look very similar to the pieces, or to the creatures that are actually in the book. It's cool. It's cool to see his little mind work and him do all that kind of like problem solving stuff and making stuff. Yeah. So, but I had the devil skull pattern or knife. So I had my collaboration piece with Gabe Fletcher. We made this devil skull steel basically a year ago now. And, I still have my knife. I'm actually going to have it with me at Blade Show, but every time people looked at it, they couldn't see the devil skull at first. I had to like stand there and point out all the different features of the devil skull. And it was actually kind of annoying me. And I think part of that, the reason it was difficult is because the finish wasn't as good as I ideally would have liked it to have been. So the first thing I did when we got back from, being in Eugene, I stripped all that finish off and refinished the blade, and fucking it looks so good now, just super high contrast. And that skull, it's hard to like, you can't miss it because it's bright silver over a black background, and it looks really good. And otherwise, it was the week was a sharpening week. Did some forging, like I said. Got a knife, that knife that I had rehandled. It turned out great. Completely forgot to take pictures of it and just mailed the fucking thing off. I like to try to do before and afters and I completely forgot. So that's too bad. Yeah, that's about it. So next up is just to make more steel and move forward with making knives because oddly enough, I'm a knife maker.
Keep those goggles on. Jeez.
Yeah, keep the fucking goggles on. Jesus Christ.
Well, I've got a nice story too, actually. So
perfect.
One of the reasons we had a problem with the podcast, and it didn't really go up till Tuesday anyway, is because one of my twins, Molly, she's had a really bad turn in her eye for the last maybe 18 months. She just woke up one day and it was just gone. Her eye has just turned.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
So one eye is looking right into her nose, you know?
Oh.
If you look at her, both eyes don't look at you. One is, you know, they're wonky eyes. So she's been wearing a patch and stuff like that for the last year. Hasn't really made too much of a difference. And so she had an appointment, but it was like 4 hours away for us. And it was on a Monday morning. We're like, right, let's all go as a family. We'll take the other two kids out of school. We'll all go down. We'll spend the day. Place called Toulouse. It's a nice city as well. So we can stay there, maybe stay overnight and get back the next day. We get in the car. Within half an hour of leaving, two of the three kids are violently sick all over the car.
Oh, no.
And it was like, oh, man. And we're like, we got to go. We can't not go, you know, because you know, this appointment's taken a long time to get. So we sort of made our way there, stopping every sort of half an hour for people to be ill and cleaning the car. It was a mess. It was terrible.
My God.
The smell, everything was just the worst. So we get there and she's going to actually have an operation now to straighten the eye, which I think is a good thing because they're like a 98% success rate and all the rest, and it's not that big of an operation. I've been winding her up saying, what colour are you going to pick this time? I said, go for a brown one. So you'll have one blue and one brown. It'll look really
Christ.
Cool. And she's like, can I pick my own colour? I'm like, yes, pick whatever colour you want. So she wants a pink eye and a blue eye, and it's yeah, it's this thing. But it's not happening till August anyway, so I'll tell her the truth before then. But that's my eye story of the week. Yeah. What else I've been doing? I've been I said about all these knives that I've got that I found that I had in storage that were They were all cut out. They were all ground. They were all heat treated. They just need basically tidying up and handling. Because I had a bunch of them, I thought, well, let's just play around a little bit. And I tried doing some tapered tangs, just to see what the difference in weight would be. What a waste of time that was.
Why?
very little in terms of weight being lost.
Sure.
Because I mean, these are only thin blades. They're only 2.5 mil at the spine anyway, so they're pretty thin anyway. But I just thought it's just a way to sort of I'm trying to slowly get back into it and sort of get my chops back up on the grinder, basically. So this is a good experiment to do. Something to do. They look fine. They're nice and flat and the rest of it, but there's really no discernible difference with the weight. It was very, very little. and I'm just thinking more and more along the lines of, you know, my knives going forward, having my sort of, not a signature, but, you know, something that is clearly mine.
Style.
And I'm thinking that is more sort of a visual thing that's got no real purpose, you know, with the blade so thin anyway, had no real purpose. But it was interesting to do it. Made a couple of mistakes the first time with it, you know, with handles, not drilling holes before I tapered the tang and all the rest of it. But eventually worked it out. Then I thought, was that really worth it? And I think not. Mm. So no offense to people who do them. But I think for the simplicity of what I want, it was a lot of work for nothing. So yeah, lesson learned, I suppose, for me.
I just did a taper tang. I forged out a while ago. I forged out a short kukri and I made a taper tang. I just was fooling around with it. And I like the taper tang when you have a thick taper. Like if the taper is very dramatic.
Yeah, exactly.
Because then all of a sudden you really can see it. But if it's like, you know, 3/32 or a very thin taper, you're not really getting a whole lot of bang for your buck, like you said. Like
I'd say
visually,
you're an eighth of an inch.
Probably, I don't know. This taper was probably like almost 3/8 down to, you know, 3/32. It was pretty, you know.
Oh,
pretty
I see.
Dramatic.
The taper was okay. I was gonna say if you already have thin stock, like Craig was saying, about an eighth of an inch or less, I don't think there's any point in tapering.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But for the visual look, at least, I mean, their weight you can do differently. But I did like trying to figure out because it was a integral bolster with a tang, and it was interesting to kind of figure out how to put those scales on at
a
taper.
With a full tang?
Yeah, full tang integral bolster. Yeah. So I kind of enjoyed the whole fitting them up and then gluing them lightly with the crazy glue and then drilling one side and then drilling the other side. It was pretty good. I've done a couple of those integral taper tang integral full tapered tang ones, and it's been tricky. And I've kind of enjoyed, you know, just kind of stretching my legs on something like that. But it's
with full tangs. I mean, what I did find with the 3 or 4 that I did, I said the first time I'd messed up because I tapered the tang and then I wanted to drill the holes.
Right.
You're obviously better off drilling holes whilst the tang is flat, because then you get the right angle for your pins or whatever.
Not necessarily. You can do it. I mean, the way I did it
you can do it the other way, but it's a lot more work. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. I broke one set of tang. I drilled them all together. I glued them all together and drilled them. Or no, I drilled one side and then I put the other tang on the other scale onto the other side. Then I broke the scales and I redo it all. So I was doing it one at a time differently than the way I would normally do, you know, drilling the holes to make sure that the shanks were straight.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Got to have a straight shank.
That's what she said.
Especially on a severe taper.
Pardon me?
I was just saying, especially on a severe taper.
Yeah, on a severe taper, all hell breaks loose. If you don't, you know. But it's been a fucking wild week, frankly. We did a nice job. Our man Bob from Every Day's Feast Day and I have been talking a lot, and we've been selling knives, and which is really good. Hasn't been a secret that, you know, business hasn't been awesome, and the past 7 days have been pretty decent, which I'm really happy about. People are kind of, you know, his fans and our customers are kind of, you know, getting into it, which is great. So we're making more of those knives, which is great. And then I had some cool news from my man Christian Petroni is this chef, and he's got a new book coming out. And he mentioned to me a couple months ago, but I didn't believe him. He said that our fork is going to be on the cover of his new cookbook. And I kind of was just like,
oh, cool.
This might be like marijuana fog time. he said it to me and I was just like, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. And then he unveiled it and yeah, it's really cool. So our fork is the bubblegum lift ticket fork is on the cover, which is super duper cool. And he sent me a nice message about it. And, you know, we're really thrilled about it, which was a surprisingly great situation, which I was happy about. Mm-hmm. And
nice.
And then what's interesting is I got an apology. I got an apology. But
to who?
To you two. What? I apologize to you two.
About time. Yeah.
All right, schmuck. Now I relinquish your apology. I'm only going to apologize. Not you anymore, Craig. I'm not apologizing to you anymore. You're out. Just to Mareko. I was a little bit hot last week on the AI talk, and I listened back to it, and I didn't really let you guys talk a lot, and I was a little bit I didn't like my tone. I didn't like my tone. We didn't talk about this off air. I listened back to it. I didn't like my tone, so I apologize to both of you, and it most likely will happen again, and I'll apologize when that happens again. But I want to apologize because I got a little hot, and I think that I was unreasonable.
Passionate.
I was unreasonable. Unnecessary and unreasonable, and I apologize.
Yeah. I'm fine.
All right. Well, I'm just, you know, I
that
I don't
could
need
be your Instagram bio. I
don't need to be
an unreasonable.
I don't need well, it is however, funny enough,
I appreciate the conversation. I think it's good to be able to have conversations.
It was a good conversation, but I was seeing red. I was like crazy. And the crazy part was afterwards I did some, you know, Facebook thing. And one of my fucking art school friends who wrote me this, you know, intelligentsia thing that it was like about art and like I'm wrong and just this whole fucking – and I wanted to – it was just like I was wrong because he was giving me this like art shop philosophical bullshit. And I said, well, fuck you too. And that's all I wrote back. He wrote me this like, no, I didn't write fuck you. I said, well, fuck that too. I don't care. I don't fight on the internet. I don't care for the currency of engagement. And, you know, he wrote me something and I didn't like it. And I was just like, and all I could think of is this is the reason why people don't like artists is because shitheads like you. Not shitheads. I apologize to him. I gotta apologize to everyone.
Watch that tone.
I don't like the tone. I don't like the tone. But it's like, this is the reason why people don't like artists either, because some of them are too, you know, esoteric and intelligent, too smart for their own good. And it was like, but the best part was I started to make work. I'm starting to make sculpture again, paintings and sculpture. And I've been spending a lot of time, and I'm actually going to I used to use my old basement as a studio and it turned into a shit house. And I told my wife, I'm like, I want my studio back. So we're going to clean the basement out. I'm going to make sculpture again. And it's really cool because it's like, it was out of spite of all this AI horseshit. And it was like, I apologize to you, but I'm glad that I was so hot under the collar because I actually started making work again. And I don't have enough time in my day. And now I'm up at 4:30. I've been running. I've been ready for the goddamn marathon. And now I got a business to run. And now I want to make sculpture at night. It's like, so it's been good.
Yeah.
I feel trying to fight being, you know, my age.
Yeah, I was reflecting on that conversation actually the other day. And I was like, what is it? I was actually having a hard time. Like, I feel like I didn't articulate my side very much or very well. And I figured out a way to relate it to shit that already exists before AI.
Go ahead.
So if you look at Rolex or Coach or whatever, these high luxury brand shit, they have their own version of knockoffs. AI is like a knockoff of real artists' hard work. Rolex doesn't give a fuck about these knockoffs. Coach doesn't give a shit. Actually, you were saying, what if a company could push a button and produce a Mareko Malmasi knife? And actually, there is a company that did that with Bob Kramer shit.
Right.
They had a relationship, and then that relationship ended. But they kept making knives that looked like Kramer knockoffs. But the reality is they're always going to be a fucking knockoff. And people who really care, your true audience, the people that really want your stuff, are always going to come to the original creator, the artist, whether it's prints or whether it's one of one work, to buy them.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
That work from those people. So knockoffs have existed throughout time immemorial, right? And so I think it's, but again, it, in my opinion, still stands like it really comes down to an artist. If they're trying to do this, whatever their art is, as a business, they got to fucking bust their ass to really, it's kind of carve out a place for themselves. And if they can't, or they won't, or they don't, that's on them.
So apart from the quality of the work, which you've got to assume is always going to be better, I mean, if we're talking about your work and a knockoff of your work, I'm always going to assume that yours is going to be better quality. What other differentiator could you use to show people that this is the genuine article? Like serial numbers, have a serial number checker, anything like, you know, I'm working out how people can see what, because the untrained eye.
Right.
I'm sure there's many people who you could find a knockoff and they wouldn't be able to tell the difference. They wouldn't know.
Yeah. So I think the, honestly, I think incorporating technology somehow, especially using the blockchain potentially, or some other way to authenticate that individual piece is just from you, is the best thing you can do. And I think the potential with the blockchain, I think people are already connecting like physical objects like paintings and stuff like that in the real world to the blockchain, or so that the tracing of where it originally came from to where, who's the actual owner of that thing, it already exists in some, at some level. And I think that's honestly the only thing we can try to do, other than just, again, as creators and artists and makers, trying to develop those relationships so with our ideal audience or potential clients, so that they're coming to us for our stuff. And the reality also is that I'm not trying, me, Craig, Jeff, a lot of the makers listening to this, you are not trying to sell your work to everybody. I think that's one thing we mistakenly think is, I want everybody in the world to own my ship. The reality is, one, that you can never produce that much work, but two, like, the part of the reason that people, I believe, are buying our stuff is because of the visceral human connection with the original creator of that work. So, but when it comes to like figuring out how to distinguish, like physically distinguish the difference, I mean, I think one, you got to try to do work that a commercial manufacturer of some sort can't just push a button and do, like, make, you gotta, if you really want your to distinguish your work, you gotta make it unscalable, almost impractical in a way, or at least one, yeah, like a particular, yeah, aspect that is impractical and unscalable, so that the only way somebody can get that and know for sure that it's yours is because it has that particular feature.
I wonder if anybody's making anything with RFID chips in, like, in the handle, for example.
I am.
You are? Uh-huh. Well, there we go.
And I think there's a maker, I just saw a post, some maker from Europe, but yeah, in the last couple of years, I've started using NFC tags. And so it's a near field communication tag. You can throw that into your piece, yeah, and it, you can have a, basically a private page that it links directly, yeah, to. You can password protect that chip or that, whatever the tag. And that is another way to really, like, in, and people can literally scan the work with their phone and it pulls up that dedicated, yeah, page. Yeah. Yeah.
Can Reasonable Jeff come out?
Is Reasonable Jeff in the house?
Holy shit!
Yeah, this is Jeff kicking off.
God damn it! Reasonable Jeff has something to say.
Let's hear it.
Now, this comes from, you know, a different aspect of this whole thing. And I'm not comparing myself to anybody else. I'm not saying this is right and that's wrong. when you, I've said for years, if you want to be an artist, it has to be a compulsion. It has to be something that you do with if you're on a deserted island, you're going to make sculpture. You're it's a part of who you are.
Right.
When you're making art, the problem is we constantly, and this is something we do on this podcast, and it kind of drives me crazy, but at the same time, it's because knives are a commodity. You know, you're not collecting knives as like, you know, window dressing. Not many people are using it as art, you know, or hanging on the wall. People use it, and, you know, you can only make so much knives and you got to do something with them and they become a commodity. A lot of times artists aren't thinking about their work in regards to as a commodity. It's just who they are. I make sculpture all the time that's never planning on going anywhere. I make sculpture all the time because I like to make sculpture. I make sculpture maybe not for for an audience at all. Or maybe my wife likes something and I kind of fool around with it and it might not go anywhere. I never really try to think about my work as a commodity. It's just the person that I am. I've been making art since I was a child with my dad, painting, sculpture with my sisters. You know, when you're not trying to, I'm not commoditizing the work that I've done, and the work that I've done comes from a place of this journey. It sounds lame, but at the same time it is, because you make something and then you're kind of making something off of vein, off of what you just made, and everything. Every time there's this difference, maybe you're talking about your work and why did you do this, and this is the reason why I'm doing that, and it's a personal part of who you are. You're vulnerable. When you're an artist, you're vulnerable because it's coming from a place of, you know, the person that you are at the time. So when we talk about it as a commodity and knockoffs and all that stuff, I never think about it knockoffs. What I think about as in the work that I do now comes from, let's just go with 30 years of exploration in terms of what I want to be doing and where I want to go. There's a fingerprint. So it's far more personal to me than, you know, if we're just talking about making knives. Eh, a guy makes a knife that looks like mine, though. It's how do I make sure that they're my audience is. When you're an artist, and I'm talking about a serious artist who really is just like, this is who you are, whether anyone sees it or not, it becomes very personal when you have to worry that all of your research and all your work and all your evolutions and your innovations are just, someone's going to just bypass all that, throw it in the garbage, and then make something in the style that you're making. It becomes, that's one of the reasons why I was so unreasonable last week. Cause it was just like, my eyes were burning out because it was just like, you guys don't understand that, you know, we say we're artists, but like if it becomes a compulsion, it becomes something that I'm going to make sculpture, whether if I'm the last person on the planet, I'm still probably going to make sculpture. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
And if somebody is just like ripping off all of your work, like that guy from Studio Ghibli, all the imagine, you just like, okay, the cheeks look like this, this looks like this. Next thing you know, we put it in a filter, and now you're stealing all of his intention. It hurts. It hurts. So, like, I think when you speak to other artists, we can talk about authentication, talk about knockoffs and all that stuff. But at the same time, it's like you're stealing almost like the essence of who somebody is.
I gotcha. Well, and I think actually in the last, it's interesting to hear you say all that stuff about in regards to kind of different definitions or your definition of an artist, because I feel like I've actually come to that same conclusion that an artist is somebody who is compelled to create, whether or not it's sold or not, or seen or not. It is, it's just an internal need or compulsion, like you said, to bring something out of their head and into the world. And I don't know. And I've been trying to like, are you still an artist when you basically start like whoring out your wares and start selling and commoditizing them?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm gonna let Reasonable Jeff's back. Finish what you were saying. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, and I don't know. I think, well, and like you said last week, like, unfortunately, it's hard to really do a whole lot about, you know, if some big company is trying to rip off my work. You know, they got thousands and thousands of dollars to put behind lawyers if I wanted to approach him, where I got fucking diddly shit to put behind an attorney of some sort to try to stand up for my work. And you can flail your arms around, but really you're almost like, you're not necessarily tilting at windmills, but you're just like, you're making a fuss. But really, I think, like, ultimately it's not going away is the reality. And so it's like, how do we adapt is a more interesting question.
But it's also educating people that you're, you know, like we had friends who used to come to New York and we'd take them around and you'd see these guys selling knockoff purses on the streets. You fucking tell them that's stolen shit. You know, you don't just be like, hey, there's a good deal over there. You know, yeah. I think that I guess one of the reasons why I got so crazy about it last week was, I make jokes on whether or not is art or not art. I got people who are identifying as artists and they do this goddamn Studio Ghibli and it doesn't even like come into their brain that this is like a degree of the antithesis of who they're referring themselves to. And for
I disagree there.
Go ahead. No questions this week. We're gonna fuck. Unreasonable. The Hulk is gonna come out at some point. I guarantee.
Okay. Before we do that, there's a bit of a teaser there. Before we do, let me tell everybody all about MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. Lawrence is the man. Everything we mention on the show, when we do talk about knives, Lawrence will have them in stock. He's the one-stop shop for knife makers. Steel belts, handle materials, tools, forges, kilns, and much more. Always 10% off if you buy a 10-pack of belts. Great stitches. Great, great stuff. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com and Maritime Knife Supply on Instagram.
And they are the sole sellers of the Dharma Steel Invitational Steel.
Let's do that. Let's tell everybody about the Dharma Steel Chef Invitational. Go on, Jeff.
Oh, I got to get my... You got to... Reasonable Jeff lost his glasses.
Go ahead. Holy shit!
All right. Guys, listen to me. Stop playing around. I want you to go to damasteel.se, and I want you to get the... Sorry. I'm not doing a good job right now. You all got me all fucked up. Just go do the Damasteel, and I'll chip in with what I'm supposed to chip in with.
Okay, the Dharma Steel Chef Invitational. We've been doing this for years with them now. So the Chef Invitational is almost like an end of year party. It's a bit of an award ceremony. People can contribute their work. We can all have a look, and they pick winners. That kind of thing. It's always a good evening. But we do a build along with that as well. So if you've never used Dharma Steel before, this is the perfect opportunity to use Dharma Steel and do a build along with the rest of the Knife Talk listeners. So we have certain sort of.
I have the information now.
Go for it.
All right. There's a foot-long bar of RWL-34 to create a culinary blade. 2 inches. That's 2 inches. The length of the bar is 2 inches by 1/8 inch by 12 inches or 51 by 3.2 by 333 millimeters. Plus a bonus 2x2x1/4 or 50 millimeter by 50 millimeter by 7 millimeter. Hemspringer. That's it. To create an accompanying piece or feature for the culinary knife. And apparently the RWL looks blue in mirror polish. So go to Maritime Knife Supply if you want to get all the steel for the build along from Dharma Steel.
Yeah. And go take a look at dharmasteel.se as well, and you'll see the kind of things people make with Dharma Steel. They've got a special page set up for the DCI, which is the Dharma Steel Chef Invitational, too. Go take a look. Right, where were we? Yes.
You were disagreeing with what I
was disagreeing. A bit of a problem with what you're saying.
Go ahead. Good.
I think, you mentioned, you know, some people call themselves artists. They may be using AI or whatever. I think 20, maybe 30 years ago, people were looking at digital art and going, look at these idiots. You know, they've got a computer. They think they're artists. And now that's a legitimate form of art, which people agree with, you know. I think technology moves on. And I think maybe we just need to find a way to embrace this, to protect our work. And, I mean, there's still traditional arts out there. But there's no doubt in the world. There's plenty of new art as well, and these people are artists. They, you know, they master a tool to create something. And although the current tools for AI are very sort of prompt based, as in please will you make me XYZ, I think that's just scratching the surface. Now I think we will get to a point where people can exploit that a lot further and make real sort of meaningful art.
I agree with you. Except for one thing. Now, I totally agree with the idea that when new art comes out, the old guard doesn't like it. And I'm one of those people. Now, I'm officially one of those people. Like, I don't like certain... Like, my friend Bree Pettis, who I've had on Full Blast, and you know Bree, he has this company called Bantam Tools, and they started making these... He's one of the biggest collector of plotter art. And I've told this about it, you know, a year ago.
Well, just as a point there. So Brie invented MakerBot,
right,
which were the first sort of consumer based 3D printers,
right,
if you like. And people are doing great things with 3D printing, but also people are doing terrible things by knocking other people's work
right
off.
Right. Well,
so that's another example of that. Really, you know, there's always going to be a subsector of people who will exploit others. But there's going to be a big subsection of people who will use the tool to create new and exciting things.
Well, I'm going to take some lithium and have him on back on Full Blast because he has a company called Bantam Tools in Peekskill in our town. And he opened up a space and he's creating – he loves plotter art, which is – plotter art is almost like this X and Y axis, and you can plug in a paintbrush or you can plug in a pen or – and then you have computers. You can design an algorithm and then designs – it's basically calls it art machines.
I've seen them.
And
they're
drives me
–
it's cool, but it drives me crazy.
Oh.
Because it drives me crazy, but he's my friend, and I've had him – we forged a friction folder, and I said, no calipers, no, there's going to be zero rulers. I want you to have the opposite effect of all the, you know, stuff you do. So he's a good friend of mine. He's due to come on, and I'm just going to have to, like, I don't know, do some yoga or something like that, or do a couple bong hits before he comes on, because I'm going to go out of my mind, because he has these things called art machines. It drives me crazy. Yeah. Now, the digital art thing, I think, is interesting, but and I think that what's interesting is I totally – and, Marika, you said something last week about – the idea that AI is a tool. And we actually have some listener feedback from some people who have computer program information. I agree with the concept of the tool if you're using the tool. But if the tool has the mind of its own to take, you know, your paintbrush, but it only paints in the style of Robert Rauschenberg, that's when I have the problem. I don't have a problem with the tool. Like when I went into, we had actually one of our listeners, Jacob Stout, came by. He got the Maritime Knife Supply scholarship to go to the New England School of Metalwork. He happened to be driving through. He and I went got some coffee, and great kid. He's there right now. Awesome kid. He's having a blast. Thanks to Maritime Knife Supply for doing that. And we went into Bantam Tools, and we just, you know. And I said, yeah, some of the, and I might have said a little bit on the loud side, yes, this AI, this isn't that AI bullshit, you know, on the art machines. And the guy said, well, I hate to say it, but some of it is. And I'm like, all right, well, we won't. And so I said, I won't look at that then. And I got a little hot. But I think that technology is important and it's good. And it probably has inspired me to work harder on my own work and to make sure that there's some humanity in my own work, which always has been. I'm not one of these pointillist motherfuckers. I believe in the idea of allowing this. I'm not. I have friends of mine who do that ultra realistic paintings. It's fucking some circle jerk is what that is. That's like,
really?
Look how good. Yeah, I think it's. I think it's.
I disagree. I
think it's fine. I'm back to being normal. I apologize to those circle jerkers.
It's a different type of art, and I think if we don't embrace technology going forward, we'd never put a Katy Perry in space, for example, and what a sad world that would be. You know,
I think that there obviously people have different opinions of what they like and what they don't like. I think that I just would hope that people who identify as artists would be more thoughtful in regards to what art is and not be so callous when they're talking about it. It's almost, I just feel like it's like a word that people use to make them seem more important than they are. And I take it very seriously. I take art very seriously, whether I like art or not. I take it seriously. And I've devoted a lot of my life to it. And when I see it, I find it to be, frankly, I find a lot of it to be offensive. So to like,
but I'm sure a lot of people thought that when they first saw like a Mondrian or something like that.
Yeah, of course. Like,
you know,
yeah,
it's just, that's what art does. It gets people talking. It gets people having opinions.
But if you're just talking about, all right, reasonable Jeff's back for a second there, the Hulk, one eyeball got like your daughter's and looked big and pink and crazy. And then all of a sudden I just brought it back. It was like, when somebody who just decides to just make art by taking their picture, they don't give a shit about art. They take their picture, they throw it through a filter, and then it looks like something. That doesn't mean they're an artist. I need more. I need you to talk about it. I need you to be able to explain your decision making. I need more than just, it's a pretty picture and that's the way it is. But that's me. I'm fucking unreasonable. I'm unreasonable. I take it seriously. It's not like I'm, like I said, reasonable Jeff, reeling it back in. I got to reel it back in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sticking it to you a bit here.
Fine.
I agree.
I already apologized once. I'm not apologizing.
I do think AI is worrying. The fact that it can duplicate and copy people's work. I agree.
Somebody's going to say, hey, ChatGPT, write me a song, and I want it to sound like Piss on My Party from the 355s. And then you're not going to like it so much.
No, I do agree. I am sticking it to you a bit.
It's fine.
Rattle your cage.
It's fine.
See where we go.
I just, I also probably want some of these people to not call themselves artists too.
It's an exclusive club.
You have to
go to school to become an artist, right?
Well, I mean, no, but I think that you should. I think that when people talk about being I'm reeling myself back in again, Marek. I'm not apologizing again. I think that at a certain point, it's like if you decided you were a plumber just because you watched a lot of plumbing YouTube videos, and you didn't, I think that there is work to be done when you're an artist, and I think that you need to learn. I think that there are certain things that you should learn. And if that makes me an old fogey, then fine. But at the same time, I take it seriously. I take it seriously.
For me, I feel like art has always been kind of a free-flowing thing. And I feel like it's really interesting hearing you talk about it in such kind of like regimented terminology
structures and
definitions. When I'm like, what?
If you went to college and went to an art program, and then you went into a drawing program, it is like the most regimented thing you'd ever be in. It's almost like it's crazy. And it's hard because a lot of people want to draw the way they want to draw. And my art teacher, who was covered in tattoos, he was a logger from Montana with a graduate degree. He was a real intense drawer. He's like, this might not be fun for a lot of you people. And he was fucking tough. And he was like, you need to learn the fundamentals before you can do it. It's just like blacksmithing. You need to learn the fundamentals and then you can break free. But you also, part of it is
I disagree hugely there.
Okay,
I think I do too.
That's prescribed art, that you're being told how to do it and what to do. And to me, that is the complete opposite of what I believe art to be,
which
is an expression. I don't even need to be good at it. I mean, I can try some pottery.
Fine.
I'm shit at it, but I'm making something. I'm creating something, and I think I'm using the artistic side of my brain to do that.
Yeah, I think like a somebody who's creating, at least in my mind, is truly being artistic in creating something. Not only does it not matter if anybody sees it or not, but it also doesn't matter what anybody else fucking thinks about it. Because
in their mind
and what they're doing is a pure expression of their own creativity, whether it's defined as good or bad by anybody else. It comes down to how that person feels about the process. I feel like it's more of like a practice more than anything. And it being too heavily defined as good or bad, or needs to be this style. You guys keep naming all these artists, and I'm sitting here with the rest of the audience probably being like, who the fuck are they talking about? Rauschenberg and more whatever Craig said.
Mondrian.
Mondrian. Yeah. Just, I don't know, are these recipes or are these people?
But, well, I mean, you know, this is once again, I mean, this is part of that whole idea of like, you know, I really took art history very seriously. And like listening to these people and kind of talking about work, and my sister's a curator, and when I go to a show, we talk about work and we try to kind of find out what's happening. And I take it more seriously than others. And
but
you know, you're
it
right.
Feels like you're saying that people who didn't go through the same stuff can't necessarily
no,
be
that's
taking
not
it
true.
Seriously. Because it almost sounds like you're saying, unless you do and struggle through and dedicate the time like I did, whatever you're creating isn't real art.
That's not what I said. I didn't say any of that. I said I take it seriously. And I think that once you start to take it seriously, then you become more offended by, you know, what AI art would probably be more offensive to you. Like I really, you know, when I think about the struggles of trying to make my, you know, make sculpture for a show and then having my work rejected from a gallery and really, you know, it was a very vulnerable situation. You're constantly put in these positions of being very vulnerable with what mm-hmm. you're doing. I'm not saying, I'm not the guy, don't make me be the guy at the door saying whether or not you can be an artist or not.
That's what it sounds like. You're playing the, if you don't go through the school and hard knocks,
I'm not,
like
not
we
saying,
did,
I never
you're
said
not
that.
Fucking real artist.
I'm reeling myself back in because I'm not apologizing again, but I am saying this. When you want to know why I find it to be offensive, it's because I put a lot of time and energy into my work, which I don't need. Most of my work, I don't even like. Like, I'm still trying to find out what the kind of work I want to do. And I just take it more seriously than some people. And to me, I found, because of my experience, I found these AI filters and AI art. I find it to be offensive to people who are spending their life long, you know, I find offensive. There's a great one of my favorite sculptors of all time. No,
holy shit.
Stop it. We're having a good conversation.
Brancusi? Is it Brancusi?
There's a very okay. famous American sculptor. Everyone had not heard of him, but they know of his work. His name is Alexander Calder. He came up with these kinetic sculptures that he called mobiles. They hang from the ceiling and then they have different weights and they move around. And then all of a sudden, this concept of the mobile was stolen and it was turned into everything from other sculptors were making it and calling it mobiles to kids, you know, babies have mobiles over their beds. And all of a sudden, it's just like you've taken something that this guy's created, including the word, and you've taken it. You've taken it from him. And I find that to be offensive. So that's my own, you know, I'm my own person.
So if something becomes popular, do you think it degrades the art? Is that what you're saying?
But I think that, yes, I think it does degrade the art.
What about if you share it with people publicly or commoditize it, then you are submitting it to the opportunity for it to go through this kind of ripoff or being stolen. Well, and I feel like the same way an artist who is creating for art's sake shouldn't necessarily care what other people's opinions are about it because it's about the creative process, then why do they care also about, just like the copying stuff or AI? It seems like the only context in which that really actually matters is the commoditization of the art. Outside of it, it seems like it really shouldn't fucking matter because the artist is always going to continue to evolve, as you like to say, and create continuously until the fucking day they die, right?
I can't tell you if I'm not saying other people can do whatever they want. Certain things I find offensive, and that's okay. It's my right. I don't owe it. No one has to be punished for me being offended by something. I think that I honestly believe
right
that. Pardon me?
Nothing.
I agree with what you're saying. I have my own opinions on art, and I'm not going to change. I do think that at some point, this is the beginning stages of a giant. And we had a guy. Actually, I'm going to read this. We're going to do a listener feedback that it works with this thing.
Okay. Before you do, let's cut to a commercial break.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
Okay, hold what you got. Let me find this goddamn thing. Oh, this is from Ryan Schillings. Ryan Schillings, he sent us a message, a great message, on Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. He said, hey, Knife Talk, wanted to chime in on the AI topic. I'm a STEM subject matter expert, and one of my side gigs is writing science questions to stump AI. Even when I give it the answer. So I trust me, AI can create, but creation lies with the human condition. It doesn't have instincts, doubt, or inspiration. It just reflects. It's like stock removal. It doesn't make you less of a bladesmith. Well, that's where you're wrong, because it doesn't make you a bladesmith. Sorry, but I do have a problem with that. It saves you time, and your grinder does the heavy lifting. AI is the same. It's not replacing us. It's doing the grunt work so we can focus on the craft. If it could really copy me, I'd be out of a job, but I'm not. The spark is still ours. I love the show, and you guys have helped me up my game, and I just wanted to say thanks. This is great, but
it's a great line, the spark is still ours.
But you fucked it all up. But when you said, it's like stock removal, it doesn't make you less of a bladesmith. Doesn't
like
make
Craig's
going
to steal that line and put it in a song.
Doesn't
I
make
like
you
it.
A bladesmith.
The spark is still ours. Doesn't... That's the title. That's the title we got as well.
Oh, the nice spark job. Is still ours.
STEM, what was it? A STEM research? What was it?
He says a STEM subject matter expert.
What is that? Science, technology, engineering, and what? Mathematics?
Mopping.
Mopping. I think it's mathematics.
Yeah, probably. I once again, I agree with the idea. You know, look, I agree with the idea of us as knife makers being able to use water jet. You know, I use water. I'm not going to pretend like everything I do with like my teeth. I have water jet. I have knives that I design that New Jersey Steel Baron has, and then I call them up and I need some blanks and they send me the blanks. Did I not do it because I had them? If they were to sell my designs to someone, I'd be irritated too. You know, yeah. If they gave my designs to someone, I'd be offended too. So
that's a commercial thing as opposed to an art thing. But can I? What I think you've had a formal education in art, so you're very comfortable with, and you've got experiences, and you've taught yourself how to, and you've gone deep into tearing things apart, the reason for the why of art, whereas most people haven't. So I just think we're looking at things from a different lens.
Yeah, totally
basically.
Different lens.
You know, that's all it now, is. I think fundamentally we all agree that stealing people's work is wrong. But with regards to what AI is doing, I think we may have, you know, we may be able to disagree on those things.
I completely agree with both of you, and I appreciate the both of you. And you are my friends. We've been doing this for a long time. I think this is a very good spirited conversation. Look, we don't have to agree on everything. It's fine. But I appreciate and I respect you. And I did this in a way where I wasn't fucking losing my brains. So I appreciate it. We can hit this another time. Do it again. And
do you feel
peace and love? Peace and love.
Can I say one last thing?
Please go ahead.
I know we've been. Who talking
listen, I'm ready to fucking. Rock. I'm ready to Let's keep going. It. You know, don't worry about that.
Yeah. No. does it almost feel like we're focusing on the wrong thing, because we're talking about AI, but it's not operating on its own. It's being used by people.
Yes.
So should the frustration actually be with the people?
Yes, you're 100% right. My frustration is with the number one, I think the people who have that whole Studio Ghibli thing. I think that was a really shitty thing for them to do. And then there are going to be some copyright issues. I have more of an issue of the people using it, saying it's okay, and not understanding why it's a problem. Like and I'm not thinking about AI in general. I'm thinking of like these goddamn filters that people are using, like the, you know, that are taking the likenesses of other people's work. I have more of a problem with the people who are using it rather than the thing that in and of itself.
Yeah.
And then identifying as artists, I got a problem with that. Like you, I think that, you know, I find it to be, you know, I'm not going to say it anymore, but it's fine. But I mean, look, I, you know, it's a good topic of conversation. That
for sure. It is. You know, it is. Yeah. And it's good that I wouldn't say the three of us have completely different opinions, but we have varying opinions between us. And I think that's important that we can talk about those things without, you know, throwing our toys and, you know, putting the phone down, you know? Yeah.
Taking my ball and I'm going home.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's all good. Do we have any more listener feedback? And then maybe we'll hit a question.
Yes. I think we're going to do the... Corey Phillips says, hey, guys, I have some feedback on the thin edge debate. All right. So this is Knife Talk Buck, ladies and gentlemen. I know the last 54 minutes didn't feel like it, but it certainly did. It certainly is. All right. So Corey Phillips, we were talking about the thin edge. I don't know if I even... Did I do that last week? Did we talk about the thin edge?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Hey guys, I have some listener feedback. Do we do the thin edge? Let's just all right, let's read it and see what Corey Phillips says. Hey guys, I have some feedback on the thin edge debate. I think a lot of knife enthusiasts like performance and ease of sharpening a nail flexing edge that's also thin up to the bevel, but to Jeff's point, it comes with the trade-off of toughness. Almost every thin knife that I sharpen from inexperienced users always have chips or warps. Would the solution be to offer thinner versions of your existing work upon request, or market yourself as a high performance maker if you like to make thin edge knives? Good question.
I'd be curious if the knives he's sharpening, if he's offering a sharpening service and they're just people commercially made knives that people are bringing in, or if they're his knives coming back. Because I'll say in the knives that I've sharpened, a lot of the, especially the Japanese ones, because they do push the edge thinness quite a bit farther than European manufactured knives, or at least the majority of European manufactured knives, and they're making them from different steel, that they do often have chips along the edge. I think there's also a kind of a difference of idea in regards to how these knives should be used, where like in an Eastern tradition, and from places like Japan, Korea, and China, they have so many different knives because each knife has a particular job, and I think they also manufacture their commercially manufactured knives somewhat with that similar philosophy. But then those knives are sold to a Western market, especially like in the United States, where people think all you need is just the one knife to do all the things, and they end up using, kind of misusing the knife or using it on the wrong things. And those knives receive damage as a result of that. But if they are commercially made knives that he's sharpening and often seeing chips, I don't think it's fair to actually compare those to the custom made knives that I think a lot of, especially chef's knives that a lot of makers are making, because they have a tendency also, these knives from Japan, to keep the edges harder, especially if they're clad in some sort of stainless, because of the added toughness that the cladding offers to the overall toughness of the blade. But still with the philosophy that the knife is only being used on vegetables and produce and boneless meat, and without the idea that it's going to be cut on like a ceramic plate or in a Pyrex dish or used to chop apart frozen tater tots or some shit like that. And I think that's where a lot of that damage is happening. But I also feel like it's not an equivalency to compare, especially commercially made, like Japanese or high carbon steel core commercially made knives to custom made kitchen knives. Because I think you can take it to the same dimension. Take it to the same dimension and get better performance out of a custom-made knife versus the commercially made stuff.
Yeah. I think with regards to, you know, should we have a line of, you know, these are for professionals to use and these are for other people to use. I think a lot of it is we always assume that the people who are prepared to spend, whether it's a few hundred or a few $1,000 on a knife, whatever it may be, they know what they're doing. They're at the top of their game, and which is why they're splashing out all this money on a knife. I think there's just a lot of dummies out there that have lots of money who just want to buy what they consider to be the best knife they can for the money. So a lot of it comes down to, and we always talk about sort of education, you know, with our customers and things like that. But the majority of the time, we don't know who the customer is, unfortunately, really. So I think, yeah, it's a difficult one. I think the only thing we can do is just make the best knife that we believe to be. So whether it's a, you know, whether it's a chef knife or whether it's a filleting knife, wherever it may be, it needs to be right for that, for that purpose. And obviously a chef knife is going to be sort of a general purpose knife, I suppose. But we're all, again, not to bring it back to art again, we're all going to have different opinions on what we think that'll be. So, you know, having, you know, a line for average people and having a line for professionals, who's to say who's straddling that line? Who's to say what the mechanics of each of those products should be anyway? It's a difficult one. I think all we can do is just do what we consider the best we can for maybe our own personal experiences.
What do you think, Jeff?
I think that a lot of chefs don't know what they're doing either. I know some top tier chefs who brought me a knife that they misused, like a Deber or something like that, super thin, with like a fucking half a poker chip sized chip out of it. And they said, can you fix this? And I'm thinking to myself, they beat it up and they expect it to be, I don't know, miraculously repaired. You know, like I feel as though the answer is, yeah, it's obviously some people just, they don't know what the hell they're doing. You have to be very, the hardest part is, like, if this was art, it would be easy shit. The only thing you'd have to say is don't put it in the sunlight for years and, you know, make sure that it's, you know, keep this off of it, or, you know, you have directions, you know, like there's certain paints fade in the sun. So there are certain things you could do to just be like, okay. But with the knife, people are actually using it, and you can't control how they're using it or where they're using it, nor should you.
Right.
So you just don't know what people are going to do. And most likely people say they know what they're doing and they don't. You know, I know, like I said, I got this one chef, he had this chip and I was just like, bro, you got to take it to Corin. Corin is the, you know, Japanese sharpening service in New York. He's like, oh, yeah, I just didn't really want to. I'm like, well, you're turning this knife looks like a, you know, it's got like a buck tooth. it's like you knocked a tooth out of it. You know, it's crazy. So yeah. I don't really have any more to say.
I feel like there's a tendency to, for when something goes, quote unquote, wrong with the knife, for people to think that there's some falter in the knife or something, some issue with the knife, instead of realizing that they're not using it probably exactly the way the knife should be used.
Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. The first thing they say is this shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, it shouldn't happen. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, people don't, you also think that, like, when you get an object, you think that it's bulletproof. You know what's crazy? I got a knife from EDC Gearhouse, our friend Ben. And I got a MagnaCut Kershaw knife, you know. I forgot it in my pocket and went through the wash probably 10 times. And it is bulletproof. This thing is sick. I mean, I'm shocked. I'm shocked that there's zero rust, there's zero problems. I'm stunned. And it makes me think, well, I mean, I was stupefied. I'm stupefied how good it is.
It's built for that purpose, isn't it? Yeah.
Not
for going through the wash.
But I mean, at the same time, I can't even tell you how many knives I've made, and I should know better. But it happens. But at the same time, it's just like, it's not like, oh, I turn rusty, I got to call up Ben, what the fuck's going on with this knife? All I can say is how come I can't do shit like this? Where it's bomb-proof. This thing is bomb-proof. Been through the dishwasher. It's been through the washing machine. It's been through the dryer. It's been slamming around in there. It's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, but that I said, that's the purpose. You try and, you know, finely slice a tomato with that, and you're probably going to have difficulties compared to a streamlined chef knife.
This thing is, I'm telling you, this thing is perfect. Nothing wrong with it. Beat the brakes off this thing.
Is MagnaCut a new sponsor? Yeah.
No. I am shocked that, you know, there are certain things that handle some abuse and some things don't. And it's
exactly.
You know,
I mean, if you think of cars, people would think maybe a Ferrari is the best car in the world. If you think that, fine. But then you try driving that round, you know, busy cities, and it's probably the worst car in the world for that purpose, you know? And I think that's the way to look at you know, at knives or anything.
It's like taking a Ferrari off-roading.
Exactly, exactly.
Or using it on a
exactly.
farm.
Exactly.
Now,
yeah.
I hate
There's
to,
better tools for the job.
I hate to break us up, but there is a... I have something funny to tell you. So, I, you know, in this podcast, we've been doing a lot of audio messages, right?
Hmm.
And they've been great. And if you want to send an audio message to us, it could be feedback, it could be a question, feel free to do so. So our man, Leonardo Lee, been unbelievable voice. Unbelievable voice.
Yes,
unbelievable voice. He sent a great question, except for he made one little crack that I told him. I'm like, this is like 15 minutes before we record. I said, you have 15 minutes to redo this or I'm going to break your balls relentlessly. So I'll play the original one to him, but then I'll be like, but I'm going to kick your ass a little bit. So then he just re-recorded a new one. And I haven't heard it yet, but I do want to play it. So here is the new question from Leonardo Lee. Oh, shit. Hold on a second. It's because I have to turn my volume up. I need to turn my volume down, and it's just like a whole production.
To defend Craig's honor.
All right.
Hello. Just chiming in to defend Craig's honor.
Is that C-3PO?
In the last episode, people were accusing Craig of putting dangerous ideas into the world, saying that his airtight heat-treating tank notion was effectively a bomb. These accusations are pure slander. I have done the maths, which I will spare you, but a sealed tank taken from room temperature up to 1,000 degrees Celsius would have around 4.5 atmospheres of pressure. A bottle of champagne has around 5 atmospheres of pressure in it, and idiots are opening those all the time. So let there be no further misinformation and no further injury to Mr. Lockwood's good name.
Well, that was the second...
Good song, but that, C-3PO.
That was
people questioning my genius.
You know what? You know what though? Can I just now? I have to play the first one that I was going to kick his ass about because this is actually funnier because it's like, all right, I'm just going to read the. This is the first message he sent us.
Yeah.
Greetings, knowledgeable gentlemen, and also Craig. I recently made a paring knife and discovered, to my horror, that I can't balance it across the corner of a box of strawberries. So my question to the three of you is. What is the smallest, most trivial of details that you keep in mind while making your knives?
Now, the funny part is that's the first one. And I said, listen, you can't expect to make a crack at Craig without me kicking your ass a little bit. So then he did the fucking C-3PO. How dare you blame Craig for trying to create bombs?
Brilliant.
So, good man.
Brilliant.
Good man, Leonardo Lee, a.k.a. C-3PO. Yeah. So is there anything you guys make... A little detail that you're very aware of when you're making a knife that people maybe not know.
I mean, I think for me, I'm doing predominantly integrals. And so the way that I round off the choil and the way that flows into the integral is a super important detail to me. Because the hand that, you know, usually for me, it's either my middle finger or my index finger is going to be hitting that area of the knife the most. Usually my middle finger. And I want it to be comfortable, and it's really important to me. And I really, I probably spend probably more time than is necessary there just to make sure it's really dialed in.
What about you, Craig?
Comfy.
Craig.
Yeah.
Craig.
It's a difficult one. Cause I think, my stuff is very sort of simple and, you know, very simplistic. But I think it's maybe the hidden things. So, I mean, we all do it, but I think the end user probably doesn't know things like weight relief in the tang, you know, removing stock there from within the tang. And other things which are probably a bit more measured, such as making sure my epoxies, you know, they're stored at the ideal temperature, you know, the ideal working temperatures and all that kind of thing. It's just like little details like that the end user would have no idea about. So it's not to do with comfort, really. It's more about the construction. I can't think of anything off the top of my head apart from that, really.
I really round the spines of past the bolster because I've definitely, when I was in culinary school and I had to get some Wusthofs, they have very sharp spines. And if you're in the pinch position, you got to build up a callus, and that's for the birds. So I really started, and then one chef friend of mine was like, oh, I've never had this before. This is really great. So I round off the spines quite a bit, and it really, that is something that people might not notice, and usually in most of these, you know, production knives, you'll never see a rounded spine. Yeah. You'll never see it, and it's ahead of the bolster, because it's it would be impossible for a machine to do with an, you know, it's just a tough thing for a machine to do, I guess.
Can I ask a technical question regarding that technical question? Sure. So before you put your, let's assume we're talking full tang knives here. Before you put your handles on, are you marking on the spine then where the handle's going to hit, and then you round from that point, and then put the handles on afterwards?
I'm going to tell you, my secret. And after I've ground the knife on the 2x72, my broadback, obviously. And then I bring it.
Tell us more about your broadback.
So if I got to go to broadbackironworks.com and I'm going to have myself a broadback. The best machines around, if you want a 2x72, if you're a knife maker, you're a metal worker, you're removing material, this is the knife machine. This is the machine for you. If you're removing material, this is the machine for you. And when you go to broadbackironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off their parts, their attachments, the systems, the whole nine yards. So go definitely support our boys over at Broadback Ironworks. So I'll finish the grinding, and then I'll spend a lot of time on the disc sander because I like to try to knock down as much as possible, flatten, and also feather in, just kind of tighten up my edge a little bit more. And I find that the disc sander gets me there without a lot of, you know, hiccups or anything like that, and it becomes easier to hand sand. And then once it's almost ready to hand sand, I'll bring it over to the broadback without a platen on it. And then I have a block of wood, and then I'll put a 220 belt on. I have a block of wood with some Scotch-Brite on the block of wood. Basically, like, imagine this, you know, piece of like a block, you know, maybe 4-5 inches long. And then I'll take that block and I'll push from behind the slack belt, and then I will just round off the knife, and then I'll make sure that where my handle is, it's ahead of how far I'm pushing the belt into it. So that. And then I'll break the corners. Just down the spine, and then I'll turn it around, and then I'll kind of like feather in the roundness with the block.
So you're effectively making a platen with the Scotch-Brite
right.
belt behind.
Not a Scotch-Brite. Well, the Scotch-Brite is just, this is what we used to do at the metal shop where we had a stroke sander. Basically, it's a giant slack, and then you're pushing down behind, you're pushing the belt from behind down. And then you're able to kind of push the belt a little bit, and you have this little, you have a difference of what's touching the belt from not.
Got you, yeah, yeah.
So I'm doing that when I feather in the, when I kind of clean up the spine, and then I'll swap down to 800 and just kind of tune it up there. Mm. The other thing that I would say is this is something that I learned because, you know, it's, once again, it's just time. You'll see a lot of knife makers who will have their heel, you know, you're holding the knife and then the heel goes down from the bolster down the heel. You'll see a lot of guys flare it back. You'll flare that edge of that tip back, almost kind of like it's like, I don't know what the fuck they think it is, like a, you know, Sultan's sword or something. Who know the hell knows what it is. But for culinary knives, you know what I'm talking about? Where it's not going straight 90 degrees down, but it's kind of coming back towards the hand.
So I suppose you can put your finger in.
Do that, and then I break it down. But my heel is always 90 degrees, if not turned in a hair at the end where the edge and the bolster meet. You know what I'm talking about? That little point, that heel, but where some dudes like to bring it back, and then they end up with this little fucking, I don't know what you'd call it, like a shark's fin or something like that. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about, Mareko, right?
Yeah, I do it all the time.
And sometimes I feel as though when it comes back so far, it doesn't have a lot of benefit except for if it cuts you, that little nip. And I feel as though for the end user, I feel as though that's like a dangerous move because I used to do it, and then I used to nip myself with it, and I thought I'm never going to use this at all. And I stopped doing that completely.
Sure. Yeah, I think in regards to that, I've seen some people where the curvature of that dip kind of like getting carved into the blade and coming back to the heel where it would have maybe been 90 degrees, but they sculpted it in or whatever, curved it in into the blade. I think they're limited by their tooling, and so they are, yeah, they just have these giant curves that go in there, and it does, some of them come right down to the heel, and it's quite pokey, and I am not a fan of those, but I do, I call it a recurve heel, because to me, if you put it, mirrored it across the center line, it would look like a recurve bow. What's that?
Sorry, I'm trying to find a pictures to send you guys.
Oh, okay. But yeah, I like it because it almost, if it, I mean, I think if somebody's, if it's done right, it kind of acts almost like a guard that actually keeps your fingers from sliding down because it interrupts kind of your hand from sliding directly down. But I kind of, I'm all over the place. I'm usually at least at 90, if not back just a little bit, and playing with that recurve shape. Just because stylistically I like the way it looks, and functionally I like the way it works if it's done properly. I think yeah. There are people who over exaggerate that curve and are, I think, probably doing it because they see other people doing it without really without deeply understanding the purpose of it, and so it's not very well executed. But somebody who kind of gets how that's really should feel and look, I think that it is very beneficial to the knife.
I sent you a little example.
I can see. So I can see you sent an example, and I think Mareko's right. That's down to their tooling, isn't it? So they probably use like a 1-inch contact wheel in there, which gives you a real sort of thin point on there, which you could see how you would be nipping.
I mean, potentially even drilling a hole that size, just right in there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Nice. I'm going to take this opportunity to tell everybody about Indasa Rhinowet. If you're doing hand sanding, which, let's face it, we all have to do a bit of hand sanding, use the best stuff. Save some time, which is going to save you money. Indasa Rhinowet is the stuff you want to be using. And if you head on over to texasfarrowsupply.com, they sell Indasa Rhinowet, as well as anything else you could possibly need, even if you're a farrier, bladesmith, knife maker, whatever you want to call yourself, they've got it all there. TexasFarrowSupply.com. And there's a sneaky little bonus. We can get 10% off for you if you use KnifeTalk10 as a promo code at checkout. And that includes your Indasa Rhinowet too. So fill up those baskets. Go take a good look at everything they've got over there at TexasFarrowSupply.com. And remember to use KnifeTalk10 to get 10% off your entire order.
Nice.
Shall we do a question or two?
Why not?
I mean, what?
We're an hour and 15 minutes in. I mean,
we did a question. We already hit somebody's question. We hit C-3PO's question.
Yep. Oh, and it's good to know that I am a real genius, too. Thank you very much, Leonardo. Thank you. Thank you. Warded Edgeworks. I think it's Warded Edgeworks. On Instagram, has contacted us. We are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. If you've got a question, send them across to us. We especially like audio questions. But Warded Edgeworks has said, what's your best tip to improve productivity in the shop? Mareko, let's start with
you. Put the fucking phone down. that's me talking to myself. As well as, I think... I bounce back and forth between making kind of like a list of things to accomplish the next day. And I think it really helps either at the end of your previous work day or at night before you're going to bed. But to make that list, or even honestly, whatever the fuck. But if at the beginning of your work day, start out with making a list of the shit that you got to get done. Break it down however detailed you need. Yeah, make a list for yourself don't fuck around with your phone. So if at some point you're like, what am I supposed to do? You don't have to think about it. The list is right there. Just fucking do what's on the list and you'll be good. Making lists and staying off your phone will help quite a bit.
What do you think, Craig?
I'm probably the worst person to ask this question for because I get distracted. If something is shiny at the corner of my eye, that's the next hour gone. So I think it'd be down to sort of environment, really. And I'm the worst culprit for this because I've got so many different things here that could take my attention away.
Got the brewery, the studio.
but I think having an environment where there literally isn't a distraction is the way. And I think having a phone, put that on charge somewhere out of your way, where notifications aren't going off and pulling you away from the tasks that you're currently doing. It's easy for me to say these things, but it's not easy for me to do these things. I'm terrible. So, yeah, don't listen to me. The obvious advice there is to do those obvious things. Change that environment so there's just less around you to take you off task.
It's funny because this brings back to the original topic of conversation about being, you know, being serious about things. When my dad was so mad at me when I announced I was going to, well, announce, I told, he asked me what I was going to major in, and I said I was going to be a studio art major. And he was furious. And he says, you're just going to, you know, he wasn't into it. And I could tell that he was disappointed. I could tell he was mad. And the only thing I could do, because I felt like this is it. This is what I love to do. I think I'm good at it. I think I can make a go of it, I had to prove that I would take it seriously. So when I first moved into my first apartment with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, in 1996, I had to line up jobs. I had a studio, and when I went to the studio, I was there to work, and I wanted to take it seriously, because I wanted my father to know that I wasn't just some goofball who called himself an artist and just fruit around in my underwear and, you know, watch movies all the time. Like, I felt as though if I take it seriously, then he'll take it seriously. And that's how...
Fuck, your dad would have hated me.
Well, my dad hated a lot of me. My dad hated me, you know, and I did the right thing. So it was like, yeah. But at the same time, for me, it was like, it was, and I also wanted to be taken seriously. Because, you know, in the 1990s, you get out of college and you're an artist and everyone's looking at you like they're rolling your fucking eyes. You know, so I wanted to be taken seriously, and I demanded to be taken seriously by my actions. And part of it is when I went to the shop, it was to work. I was not fucking around. My friends were, you know, going out and, you know, we don't have a boss. We can drink. I put in hard work because I wanted to be taken seriously. So from day one, you know, I took it seriously. So I feel like I don't have a real, I know that if I don't have a game plan when I come to the shop, shit can go weird. Like, I know that, like, well, maybe if I start to think to myself, maybe I should just forge today, or maybe I should make a hammer today, or maybe I should, if I don't have a game plan to the point where on, like, if I have, I schedule time to make sculpture, I am fucking working on that sculpture. So to me, it's very important to be as organized as you can and disciplined and have those milestones in the day to make sure you meet those milestones. And that makes me happy. That makes that at the end of the day, I can feel good about myself. But it came from years of not being believed and out of spite. I had to do it out of spite because I wasn't disciplined when I was a kid. I wasn't disciplined at all. So I was very hungry for this to be successful.
Yeah. I think particularly myself and you, Jeff, we've got very different sort of drivers. Like what just hit me then is when you said that's what makes me happy, knowing that you've hit these milestones for the day. Yeah, my brain just works completely different to that. So what makes me happy is learning something new. And I'm always on that hunt for learning something new and going down a rabbit hole of something new, you know, which is completely, there's no structure to that at all. And that can easily see me, you know, wasting days. But those days where I do hit upon something new and then I say, I go down that rabbit hole. I like out of everybody who I know, I'm the one somebody will come to if they want to know about something. Because I know shitloads about everything, but I'm not a master at any of those things. You know what I mean?
This brings me back to something.
An inch deep and a mile wide the other day.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That's the spread thin.
This
topic of conversation
also brings me to something you said to me before, Mareko, and you said, does this mean that you can only be an artist if you've gone to school? One of the things that happens when you're an art major is you have very serious deadlines. Like projects are done and you have to learn how to be disciplined in order to make the deadlines of the critique or something like that, because it can be very embarrassing. Like if you're in a room full of 20 artists and everyone's doing a critique and you're not done, it can be very embarrassing. Not only embarrassing because your friends are breaking your balls, but your teacher's tearing you up. So like you have to, you do learn in college a degree of being organized. And it's like an early thing. I think that's one of the reasons why when people say they don't like the colleges for getting a job, you kind of learn, you're learning the fundamentals to help you along the way later. Like that's, I had to learn to hit deadlines and, you know, how long is the glue going to dry? Or how long is it going to take to, how much time before I can paint? And you learn how to problem solve in terms of making a deadline. And that was really, really helpful to me. It was an early fundamental that helped me also. So,
yeah.
To add to Craig's, and if we're moving on to a next question, just to add to Craig's and my thing about the phone, putting the phone down, something I did years ago is I turned off all notifications, especially for social media. And then I usually put my phone in do not disturb mode on my phone. You can set it up so like, so that my wife or like whoever is like super, super important can get through with texts and calls. But otherwise, other distractions are put on hold basically while I'm trying to literally be focused because I cannot stay focused myself. But yeah, I turned off all notifications. No sounds, no dots, no nothing, no banners, nothing. Because my monkey brain is just going to be like, ooh, what's that? And go right into it. And then I get stuck. And so I've had to put things into place to basically try to be better disciplined for my future self because my present self is not capable of managing that properly. It has become easier over time, but I had to plan for
it's
that
not,
future self.
It's not an overnight thing either.
No.
You know, I think that is one of the things that, you know, the hardest part is it's like if you don't like a certain vegetable and then all of a sudden you like it. Like something's going to click at some point. You're going to be like, hey, you know what? This is going to work. But it's discipline. That kind of stuff is hard. It's really hard to do. And I'm not perfect. If I don't have a very regimented game plan and come in the shop, it can be bad. I mean, it can be just as bad. I can do something and I'll be like, I wasn't supposed to do this. And I feel bad about myself. Sure. So, you know, mental problems too. Let's get out of here.
Shall we get out? Well, before we do, I mean, we've talked a lot about different types of blades and people's styles, that kind of thing. When it comes down to sharpening, how the hell are we going to make sure our edges are the same every time, Jeff?
Oh, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? You're the Tormek.
Tormek. We've been talking about this the last hour and a half. I'm out of my mind.
Tormek. Go to tormek.com or tormek_sharpening on Instagram. They've been 50 years plus. This is an awesome machine. I just used it today, and I love my Tormek. The Black TH sharpening system is awesome. They have sharpening systems for just for chisels. They have sharpening systems for knives. They have sharpening systems for axes. They have a great, if you're an axe guy, they have an awesome jig just for axes. It is pretty amazing. They have all sorts of different things.
I used that this week, actually, on mine. Yeah,
they make great stuff all the time, and it's a great company. It's a small business, and they are just a wonderful, they're wonderful people. I just had Carl Friends on from Tormek. We had a great time. Awesome, awesome company. Awesome dude. So go to tormek.com and check out what the fuss is. And when you go to Blade Show, go down to Tormek, go say hi to Carl, go say hi to Sebastian. I will definitely be down there saying hello to those guys. And I'm a acolyte. I'm an acolyte.
Yeah. It's revolutionary in more ways than
one.
They can have that.
That's the Tormek way. That's what they have. That's the Tormek way.
That's the Tormek way. Yes. Thank you all for listening. It's been a good show. It's been a good chat, actually. We've only managed maybe two or three questions, but I think the show's better for it, for that. So thank you all for listening. We shall speak again next week. Bye for now. And you may want to stick around. Should we do a bit of
Yeah, why
show?
Not?
Okay. Here we go. Have you seen the new Black Mirror yet? Anyway?
No. I've never watched any of it.
I had to stop. They're too fucking
dark.
Yeah,
I haven't watched the last few seasons, but there's a new one on, and I was in the bath and I was like, let's watch something, and I put it on, and Jesus, the first episode is incredible, and I think it's one of those ones where it's not really in the future. This could literally sort of happen now.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what fucks me up about that show.
Yeah, it's good. It's good, that first one. I haven't seen the rest yet, but I'll probably watch them a couple tonight, but that first one is really good. So it's got the guy, oh, you wouldn't know the IT crowd, it's a very British thing. Irish guy who's now sort of big sort of in Hollywood, comedian. Anyway, he's in it. It's very, very good. So, yeah, even if you're not into it, that first episode.
Comedian.
It's not as dark as some of them have.
These
been.
Goddamn Irish comedian. TV shows now.
The what, is the Irish comedian also a musician?
No. Okay. No.
These goddamn TV shows now, it's either extreme violence, incest, or like something dark. It's like fucking weird. We're like living in like a Hieronymus Bosch cartoon.
More crazy names people don't know.
Hieronymus Bosch did the famous, it was like a, you want to see, go
the,
get
the hell torture
that.
Scenes.
Yeah, you know, it's like we're living in it. It's like, it's crazy. I find it to be, I was doing a Peloton this morning and I watched Daredevil. I watched it because I used to read the comic book, and they are beating the brakes off this guy. They're smashing his skull in. And I'm thinking to myself, I used to love a cartoony. I used to love Daredevil. And now I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? It's crazy. I'm looking forward to watching The Last of Us. But at the same time, I'm just like, do I need this in my life?
I haven't seen that yet, but I've heard, lots of people are loving that.
The first episode of the second season?
I haven't seen it.
You should watch it. It's great. It's going to make you feel really depressed.
I've only seen the first season. I liked it.
Yeah, we watched the first season. I liked it too. It's depressing as hell.
There's a comfort in feeling sad, I think.
You're a psychopath.
You're like feeling better about your current situation. At least I'm not getting eaten by mushroom-infested zombies.
Here's the funny thing about Craig Lockwood. He is, of all the feedback we get, people, you have fucked a pile of our listeners up by your recommendations.
You're Rex, yeah.
And I found an article saying that, like, people who enjoy comfort in, like, what is that article I sent you? It was people who enjoy comfort in watching, like, dark stuff. It's a red flag for, like, a sociopathy or something like that.
Red flags,
you're like, you sent me back the red flag. That's you, man. You like the fucking weirdest shit. I think it's because there's one, if you follow Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, we used to do video clips. And there might have been a video clip of you running out of a chair because a spider was in the room. And most likely, I believe you were in your underwear. So that's how I picture you watching.
I don't think
yeah,
I was.
You were. I don't know if it's in the clip. I'm
usually naked. I
know that at some point when we were doing the YouTube, when we had the YouTube thing, you popped out of your fucking underpants. You were in your underpants. So now I picture you watching like Squid Games. You were watching Squid Games with your fucking tighty whities and your knob out, watching Squid Games.
I do like sort of darker stuff. I think because it takes you out of reality. You know, I'm not into like Marvel and all that sort of make-believe-y kind of stuff, but I like stuff that could sort of be real, you know? And Black Mirror sort of stuff.
I was such a comic book fan that when Batman first came out, I was so...
Was he gay?
What'd you say? No.
Very
good. Very good. The first one with Michael Keaton, I was in high school, and I was so excited because I was such a Batman fan at the time. I understand why people love it. I mean, it's a baked-in audience, so...
And all big films now, they're all part of bigger franchises, aren't they? It's mad. Right.
Well, people want to see, you know, they know that they're invested in the characters, and then all of a sudden they see someone big, and then it's an influencer thing too, because it's like, it's like there's a baked in audience.
Yeah.
There's less risk for
studios. Right, because they know people like certain characters, so they do it all over the time.
Been watching anything, Rekko? Anything?
I started watching the second season of The Rings of Power, which is a Lord of the Rings kind of prequel thing. The Rise of Sauron and all that. It's nerd shit.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like I
got dragged to a Lord of the Rings movie when it came out. I was just like, oh my God, how long is this thing? Oh, it's 3 hours long. I'm like, you got to be out of your fucking mind.
I did. The guy who was in the British office, Tim, he's in one. I can't remember. It was maybe about 10 years ago. I fell asleep in it, woke up, and there's still an hour left.
Oh, my God.
I was like, Jesus Christ.
What is, do you have any memory of the funniest movie you've ever been to in a theater?
been to?
Theater. Ooh. In a theater. I know exactly.
I saw went to Napoleon Dynamite when it came out.
Did you laugh?
Really?
So I thought it was hilarious, but I didn't laugh a single time. But after the movie, I kept recounting stuff that happened in the movie, and I was just laughing my ass off the whole time. That's how I take in humor. I rarely laugh out loud.
Tina, go get some ham.
Do you have any memories of
it? It is a classic. No. I've gone back to the cinema to see things years later, which I've already seen, which I know is funny.
I went to see Jackass 1, the first Jackass movie. laughed so hard in the theater. I thought I was having like this was 20 years ago or something like that. I remember being literally like hunched over laughing. I just couldn't believe it. It was the hardest I've ever laughed in a theater.
Wow.
Oh, Jackass was hilarious. I didn't like all the feces stuff, but I did like all the getting kicked in the balls and stuff like that. I laughed my ass off. I can watch Jackass all the time, except for all the barfing and the wee wee and all that stuff. But like all the kicking in the balls and all that stuff. If I get stuck on a Jackass clips on Instagram, just call it a night, baby. You ain't gonna see me again.
I tell you what I did watch, talking about, funny films that you rewatch years later. There's no way you guys would have seen it anyway, because it's very sort of Welsh and Welsh humour. A film called Twin Town back in the 90s. No. Oh, my God. It's just Welsh humour, like, to a T. And I found it hilarious back then, which was, 30 years ago. And I watched it again this week. It is amazing. Oh, nice. But you can't find it on any sort of streamers or anything. There is an illegal stream of it on YouTube you can watch. But it's just absolute genius. You know when something is like hyper-localized, then I think if you're not from that area, you wouldn't find it funny at all. This is my version of
it. It's like anything that plays on the BBC.
Brilliant. I think...
At least.
I think that's very sort of British. No, I wouldn't even say humor, but just sort of British way of life, I suppose, which is very different to the American way. Yeah,
there you go. I'm watching sports. I'm watching baseball.
You're watching sports. I have a hard time going to the theater anymore because it's so fucking expensive. The only reason I go to the theater is for movies that are like big, whatever, sound, like visual and sound effects. I don't go to the theaters for comedies or anything like that anymore because I'm like, I don't need the giant screen and the surround sound and the high definition for laughs. For me, it's high action.
The last movie we saw in the theater, we saw the Led Zeppelin documentary, which was amazing, and it sounded great. And then the most amazing movie I think I saw is I took my daughter to Avatar when it first came out. It was a 3D, and that was amazing. And she was really young, so it was really wild. You know, that with the 3D glasses when they used to do the 3D glasses, and I was just like, that was amazing. Yeah. But
didn't they make like three movies at the time when they're like releasing them like every 10 years or something?
All these motherfuckers are, they're just like squeezing. Is it Mareko's right? Yeah. It's just what is it, $20 for a ticket for go to the theater now? It's crazy. And then all that bullshit popcorn, all that stuff.
Oh, geez. $10 for a bucket of popcorn.
$10? It's like $15 to $20. It's like,
you're in New York.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but it's like, it's a racket.
Yeah.
It's a fucking racket. Yeah. It's a racket.
You always got to smuggle your own candy in.
That's what we used to do. It's so embarrassing. There was one point. I remember. You know what? My wife and daughter, we used to go to the Five Below next door, which was the cheap shit. We packed the bag, and it was, I don't know what happened, and I was in charge of carrying the backpack, and the guy says, I need to look in your bag. And it's filled with fucking food. And I just turned to him, I'm like, I don't have a bomb. There's nothing in here. Trust me. There's nothing. I didn't say a bomb. I said, I don't have anything bad. Trust me. And he goes, and he goes to me, he's like, I need a senior bag. And I'm like, look, we know. We know what's in this. I said, we all both know what's in this bag. Just let's not fucking play. And he says, I don't care what food you brought in. I got to look in your bag. I'm like, okay. Open the bag. It's a shit ton of food. But the best part was I turned to him and I went in my head. I said, we both know what's in this bag. We don't have to. We don't have to open it up.
I'm surprised he didn't offer like know. Buy him off and be like, no, look, no. You can take whatever you want out of
that.
No,
no, no. I was ready to just leave and not watch the movie anyway. But I just remember like I remember saying, we both know what's in this bag. You don't need to look into it.
Yeah. Did I tell you about when just a few weeks back and I went to the cinema on my own? Did I tell you? And I saw that Nicole Kidman film, Baby Doll. I just felt like the oldest pervert in the cinema. Because seriously, there was only about like four people in the cinema. We'd all spaced ourselves out. And I looked around and there's all dudes on their own. And it starts off and it's basically soft porn from beginning to the end. I knew nothing about the film. It was like, I'm going to the cinema, whatever's on, I'll go and watch it. And yeah, I was just embarrassed from like the first 10 seconds to the end. They got to the end of the film and like, we all go to get out. But you know, there's like, that's it. By the time the film was finished, maybe 10 guys in there, all sitting separately on their own. And we all had to do that sort of walk of shame as if like, oh my God, you know, as if we're all like severe perverts walking.
You're like wiping all the fog off your glasses.
Oh,
that was something else. Huh? What do you think about that?
But that big raincoat I wore, I could fit lots of food in there.
In your underwear.
I could see Craig sneaking into the cinema with like a bucket of ramen or something like that.
When I was younger, I used to go to theaters, and I used to have my coat and have hot dogs in there. I go to the hot dog guy, and I go. There ain't nothing better than having a glizzy in a movie theater. Trust me, because it's directional food.
Most
directional food. You don't have to look. That's what people don't understand about a glizzy. You don't have to look down. You know which way it's going. You don't have to look.
Shove the ween in.
You don't have to. The ramen. You can't eat ramen in a movie theater. You got to look down. But you get the hot dogs one way, baby.
Jesus.
Down the hatch.
I used to eat cup of noodle ramen with chopsticks while driving a stick shift.
Oh, Jesus.
Through town. Oh, my God.
Oh, man. Oh, madness. Anyway, with that, thank you all for listening. We shall speak to you again next week. Bye for now.